Imagine you're standing in the middle of a Chicago trading pit. It's like 1985.
Oh man, just absolute chaos.
Right. Total chaos. You've got this physical paper ticket in your hand. You're sweating through one of those brightly colored trading jackets. And there are literally 300 people screaming at the top of their lungs.
And you're just trying to be heard over the roll.
Exactly. You scream out an order to your floor broker across the pit. You're like, I want to buy, but only if the price drops to this specific level. He nods.
Yeah.
So, you think you're good.
But then the market turns.
Yeah, 5 minutes later, the market completely crashes. You try to yell across the pit to cancel the order. But I mean, your broker just doesn't hear you over the noise.
Yeah, it's too late.
It's too late. In a matter of seconds, you've just accidentally bought double the crude oil contracts you actually wanted. Your risk parameters are totally blown out,
Yeah.
and you are staring down a multi-million dollar loss. And it's all simply because of a breakdown in human communication.
It's terrifying. I mean, a single misheard word or a distracted floor clerk could literally bankrupt a firm back then.
And preventing that exact nightmare is exactly why modern markets have evolved the rules we're talking about today. But before we get into how algorithms fix the yelling problem, I got to mention this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel.
Highly recommend them.
Yeah, they've got a full Series 3 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted just like the real thing. Check it out at certfuel.com. Okay, so in our last deep dive, we talked about the basic building blocks of futures trading. The what?
Right, the market orders, limit orders, stop
Yeah,
orders.
like what price do you want and what asset are you buying? But today, we're taking those basic orders and we're making them smarter. We're layering on conditional logic, so the how long and the how strictly.
And this is frankly a massive leap in complexity. We're moving from just participating in the market to actually programming your execution strategy.
It's like coding your trades.
Basically, yeah. And for anyone preparing for the Series 3 exam, I cannot overstate how critical this material is. I mean, the National Futures Association, the NFA, they are notoriously tight-lipped.
Well, they tell you nothing.
Right, they refuse to publish exact per unit weightings. But we know from historical data that part one of the exam spans roughly 71% of the entire test across chapters 1 through 7 combined.
71%, that's huge.
It's massive, and this specific unit on order qualifiers, it is the absolute backbone of that 71%.
Which means, I mean, we need to set a ground rule immediately for you listening right now. If your study strategy is just ripping through flashcards, like trying to memorize glossary definitions word for word,
You are walking right into a trap.
a huge trap.
A trap designed specifically by the test writers. They know candidates do that. If we look at how the exam questions are actually constructed, they aren't looking for textbook regurgitation.
No, they're hunting for the rote memorizers.
Exactly. They want to trap candidates who don't actually understand the market mechanics. The golden rule for this unit is reasoning. You have to ask why. Because these specialized orders, these qualifiers, they're often just one single mathematical condition away from a lookalike order.
They're like evil twins.
Yeah, they're siblings, they look similar, they sound similar, and the exam will deliberately blur the lines in a high-pressure scenario.
I've seen the practice questions, and they are brutal. They will describe a highly specific trading scenario, put the lookalike order in option B, the real answer in option C, and they just wait for your brain to misfire.
They absolutely do.
So look, we are not going to just read definitions today. If you want to survive the exam, you have to understand the personalities of these orders. You have to understand why a professional trader would actually use them in real life.
Context is everything.
Right. So to do that, I want to introduce a cast of characters. We're going to follow three fictional traders throughout this deep dive. Having real, well, fictional but relatable human behavior attached to these abstract concepts, it makes a recall automatic.
I love this approach.
Awesome. So first up, we have Deliberate Dave.
Deliberate Dave, the architect.
Exactly. Dave is the kind of guy who builds a complex, color-coded spreadsheet just to optimize his grocery store route.
Oh, we all know it, Dave.
Right. In the market, he plans everything in advance. He sets incredibly strict boundaries. And his biggest pet peeve in the world is manual, repetitive work.
He wants automation.
He hates it. He refuses to re-enter data every single morning. He wants to design his strategy, input it once, walk away, and know the exchange's matching engine is handling it perfectly while he goes golfing.
Dave represents long-term systemic risk management. He hates operational drag, and that mindset perfectly aligns with very specific order types that we'll cover today.
Then, on the complete opposite end of the psychological spectrum, we have Frantic Fiona.
Oh boy. Frantic Fiona.
Fiona is highly impatient. She's likely running on like 8 shots of espresso before the 9:30 a.m. bell even rings.
She's a high-frequency scalper, or maybe an arbitrager.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. When she wants an order filled, she wants the entire thing, and she wants it in a fraction of a microsecond. Zero compromises. If she can't have exactly what she wants instantly, she just walks away.
Fiona is our vehicle for understanding the most aggressive, rigid contingencies in the entire market structure. She is the all or nothing right now mindset.
And finally, we have Settlement Sam.
The closing bell guy.
Yep. Sam is a macro portfolio manager. He's super relaxed during the day, but incredibly rigid about his daily schedule. Sam doesn't care about haggling over a single penny at noon.
He's looking at the big picture.
Right. He cares about matching his portfolio's value to the daily index. His only goal is a guarantee that when the closing bell rings, his positions are exactly where they need to be to match the evening reports.
So we have Dave the architect, Fiona the speed demon, and Sam the closing bell guy.
You got it. So let's start with Dave. Dave likes to set things up for the long haul. So we're looking at the concept of time and force. Basically, how long does an order actually live in the exchange's computer before it gets deleted?
Well, to understand an order that lives for a long time, we first have to really thoroughly understand the baseline, you know, the default state of the futures market.
Okay, what's the default?
The default state is the day order. It is exactly what it sounds like. It is an order that is active only for the current trading session. If it hasn't been filled by the time the closing bell rings, it vanishes. It is dead.
So going back to the physical trading days for a second, this makes perfect sense. I want you to imagine a day order as a physical sticky note.
A sticky note, okay.
Yeah, so you walk up to the Chicago Mercantile Exchange in the morning, and you tape your limit order sticky note to the front glass door. It hangs there all day, blowing in the wind, hoping another trader takes it.
Right.
But at 4 p.m., the closing bell rings. The exchange's janitor comes out, pulls all the sticky notes off the door, and throws them in a literal trash can.
A literal trash can.
Yep. If you wake up the next morning and you still want to make that trade, well, you have to write a brand new note and tape it to the door again.
It's a great visual, but let's talk about the why. Why would the exchange employ this metaphorical janitor? Why is the day order the default?
Because it seems kind of annoying, honestly.
It does, but it's about risk management for both the broker and the client. Imagine you enter a buy limit order for crude oil on a random Tuesday and it doesn't fill, and you just forget about it.
Okay, totally plausible.
Right. And then over the weekend, a massive geopolitical conflict breaks out. Oil prices open on Monday with a massive gap down, crashing right through your forgotten limit order price.
Oh, no.
Yeah. If the order was still alive, you'd instantly buy a massive position in a free-falling market, totally by accident. So the day order acts as a daily risk reset. It wipes the slate clean so you aren't held hostage by stale intention.
Ah, okay. So the janitor is actually protecting me from myself.
Precisely. But this brings us back to Deliberate Dave. Dave hates the janitor.
He hates repetitive tasks.
Right. Dave is analyzing the wheat market. Let's say wheat is trading at 600. Dave's done his technical analysis, and he decides he wants to buy, but only if it drops to a bargain basement price of 550.
Which is way down there.
Exactly. That drop might happen today. It might happen next Thursday. It might happen next month. Dave does not want to wake up every single morning, log into his brokerage, realize the janitor threw out his order, and manually re-enter a buy limit at 550.
So Dave uses the marathon runner of orders, the good till canceled order, or
yeah.
GTC.
Yes, also known in the industry as an open order. When Dave attaches a GTC instruction to his 550 limit order, he is explicitly telling the exchange, tell the janitor to leave my sticky note alone.
Leave it on the door.
Leave it on the door. This order persists across trading sessions. It survives the overnight close. It lives on the exchange's electronic book day after day, week after week, until one of two things happens. The market finally drops to 550 and fills the order, or Dave manually logs in and cancels it.
Hence the name. It is good until you cancel it. So Dave can literally fly to the Bahamas, turn off his phone for 3 weeks, and if the market crashes while he's on the beach, his order is sitting there waiting to catch the falling knife.
Exactly. Now, I will add a tiny real-world caveat here, just for the sake of completeness, even though the exam focuses on the pure theory.
Okay, what's the real-world catch?
In reality, brokers don't want their databases clogged with open orders from 2014 that a client forgot about before they passed away.
That makes sense.
Yeah, so most brokers place practical time caps on GTCs. They might auto-cancel after 30 days or 90 days. But for the Series 3 exam, you must treat the intent of the order as completely open-ended. It does not die at the daily close.
Okay, so let's put you, the listener, in the hot seat for a second. Think about Dave submitting his order on his trading software. He's at his computer. He types in buy 10 wheat at 550. Let's say he gets a phone call, he gets distracted, and he completely forgets to check the little drop-down menu for the time instructions.
He leaves it completely blank.
Right. He leaves the time and force field totally blank. He hits submit, and he gets on his flight to the Bahamas. So, what happens to Dave's order at the closing bell today? I'll let you think about that for a second. If Dave leaves the time instruction blank on a modern electronic platform, does it stay open because it's stored in a cloud database?
The exam writers are praying that you think the answer is yes.
They really are.
They want you to assume that because we live in a world where our apps remember our passwords and our Netflix history forever, that trading software defaults to keeping things open. But it does not. If Dave leaves it blank, the order dies at the close.
Wow. So the system just assumes the janitor is coming.
Exactly. On every electronic futures exchange, every single order is assumed to be a day order unless you specifically opt in and mark it DTC. GTC is an exception, not the rule.
That's sneaky.
It is. The test will give you a scenario about an electronic trading platform, describe a resting order, explicitly say the time and force was unspecified, and ask if it carries over. The answer is a hard no. Unmarked means day.
That is a phenomenal trap. It totally preys on our modern tech biases. Okay, to help lock this in under exam pressure, I want you guys to just remember this little mnemonic. GTC stands for get there, carry over.
Get there, carry over. I like that.
Yeah, it carries over night after night until the market gets there.
Before we move on from GTC, I want to plant a seed that we'll come back to. We talked about how the physical trading pit was chaotic, but think about Dave's GTC order in a modern electronic market. Okay. He leaves an order sitting on the book for 3 weeks. That means every high-frequency trading algorithm, every HFT firm can see his order sitting there. It's a resting target.
Oh, I didn't even think about that.
Yeah. In the old days, a GTC order was a piece of paper in a floor broker's pocket. Nobody knew it was there until the price got close. Today, Dave's order is broadcast to the world on a fiber optic network.
Oh, wow. So the convenience of automation actually exposes his hand to the entire market. That's a huge shift.
Yeah.
We are definitely circling back to that. But right now, I want to completely shift gears.
Let's do it.
Actually, real quick, if you're listening, physically shake out your arms for a second. We're doing a pattern interrupt because this next section is tricky. We've talked about Dave, who has infinite patience. Now we have to talk about urgency. We're moving from time and force, which is how long an order lives, to contingency,
which is how strictly an order must be filled.
Exactly. We're entering the territory of frantic Fiona.
Enter the diva of the market. The absolute most demanding, uncompromising instruction you can give a matching engine. We are talking about fill or kill, FOK.
Fill or kill. That even sounds aggressive.
It is. Fill or kill bundles two incredibly rigid demands into one single instruction. For an order to be a true FOK, it must be executed immediately, meaning the very microsecond it hits the exchange. And D, it must be filled in its entirety, meaning the total complete quantity the trader requested.
Immediate A&D entire. Right this second and every last drop of it.
No partial fills are permitted whatsoever. If Fiona asks for 500 contracts and the market only has 499 available at her price, the order dies.
Just over one contract.
Yep. And absolutely no resting on the book is permitted. It cannot sit there for 3 seconds to see if a new seller shows up. It is a one-shot, all-or-nothing execution. It flawlessly executes instantly, or the exchange automatically cancels or kills the entire thing.
Okay, let's put Fiona in a real scenario to understand why this exists, because otherwise it just sounds crazy. Fiona is an arbitrager. She has built a complex algorithm that detects when the price of gold in New York gets slightly out of sync with the price of gold in London.
Classic arbitrage play.
Right. She finds a momentary discrepancy where she can buy 100 contracts in New York and instantly sell them in London for a guaranteed risk-free profit. But the math only works if she gets exactly 100 contracts. And it only works if she gets them right now before the market corrects itself.
Because those windows close in milliseconds.
Exactly. So she submits a fill or kill order for 100 gold contracts. She's effectively screaming at the exchange, give me all 100 rights this instant, or give me nothing, because a partial fill ruins my entire arbitrage model.
And that is exactly why the order exists. Partial fills in complex arbitrage or hedging strategies can leave a trader dangerously exposed, holding a lopsided position they never wanted.
So it's actually a safety mechanism for her.
Yes, but here is the challenge for the Series 3 candidate. The exam knows that FOK is dramatic and easy to remember in isolation, so they never test it in isolation.
Yeah, of course not.
They test it by forcing you to untangle it from its siblings. The exam's favorite trick is a three-way split. There are two lookalike orders that each drop exactly one of FOK's two strict demands.
Okay, let's break down this family tree. FOK is at the top. Immediate and the entire. Let's look at the first cousin, the one that drops the entirety demand but keeps the immediacy demand.
That is the immediate or cancel order, the IOC. In some text materials, you will also see this called fill and kill, or FAK.
Oh, wait, so IOC and FAK are the exact same thing?
They are completely synonymous. Don't let the acronyms trip you up. An IOC order says to the exchange matching engine, fill whatever quantity you have available right this very microsecond, and then instantly cancel whatever is left over.
So it keeps the speed, but it compromises on the size. It allows partial fills.
Yes. The defining foundational characteristic of an IOC order is that it permits partial fills. If Fiona submits an IOC for 100 contracts and the exchange only has 60 available at her price right now, the system will instantly buy those 60 and automatically cancel the remaining 40.
Okay, wait, let me push back on this for a second. If an immediate or cancel order just takes whatever is available right now, how is that any different from a standard market order? Doesn't a market order also just immediately take whatever is there?
That is a brilliant question, and honestly, a very common point of confusion. The difference is the price constraint.
Okay, explain that.
A market order is a blank check. It says, buy 100 contracts right now. I don't care what it costs. Just keep walking up the price ladder until you get all 100.
Right, you might pay a terrible price.
Exactly. But an immediate or cancel order almost always has a limit price attached to it. Fiona says, buy 100 contracts right now, but only at a price of $2,000 or better. If you only have 60 available at $2,000, take the 60 and cancel the rest. Do not walk up the price ladder to $2,001 to get the other 40.
Okay, I get it. So a market order sacrifices price for completion. An IOC sacrifices completion for price, but demands it happen instantly. That makes total sense.
Exactly.
Okay, so that's the first cousin. And what about the second cousin? The one that drops the immediacy demand, but absolutely insists on the entirety demand.
That is the all or none order, the AON. An all or none order demands the complete total quantity. Fiona must get all 100 contracts, but it does not demand that it happen this exact microsecond.
So it can chill.
Yeah, an AON order is allowed to rest on the electronic book. It can sit there patiently for minutes or hours, waiting until the full size magically aligns on the other side of the trade.
Okay, I think we need a non-financial scenario to really bake these three options into the brain.
Yeah.
Because if you get these three mixed up, you're throwing away easy points on the exam.
I agree. Let's hear it.
All right, let's take frantic Fiona away from her Bloomberg terminal and let's put her at the box office of a concert venue. Let's say it's a highly anticipated reunion tour for some incredibly obscure 1990s grunge band. Fiona is the president of the fan club, and she needs exactly 100 tickets to accommodate everyone who flew into town. She walks up to the stressed-out cashier behind the glass.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
Let's run the three scenarios. First, Fiona acts as a fill or kill order, FOK. She slams her credit card on the glass and says, "I want 100 tickets in my hand right this exact second, or I am walking out the door with zero." She demands the full 100, that's entirety, and she demands them without a single second's delay. That's immediacy.
So the cashier looks at his screen. He sees he only has 60 tickets left in that section. Because Fiona is FOK, the cashier cannot offer her the 60. He has to say, "Sorry, I can't do it. This transaction is killed on the spot."
Perfect. Scenario two, Fiona compromises on size, acting as an immediate or cancel order, the IOC. She walks up and says, "Look, I am in a massive rush. My Uber is outside with the engine running. Give me whatever tickets you have sitting on your desk right now. Even if it's just 60, I will take them and leave. Forget about the rest. I do not have time to wait for you to find more."
So she keeps the urgency. She is leaving right now, but she drops the all or nothing demand. The cashier hands her the 60 tickets. The remaining 40 she initially wanted are canceled. She accepts the partial fill.
And finally, scenario three. Fiona takes a deep breath, drinks some chamomile tea, and acts as an all or none order, AON. She walks into the glass and says, "Listen, I absolutely cannot go back to my fan club with less than 100 tickets. It is 100 or nothing, but I have all day. I will literally stand right here in the lobby, leaning against this pillar, and I will wait for as long as it takes for you to find a block of 100 tickets."
Right. She maintains the entire quantity demand. It must be 100, but she drops the urgency. She rests and waits.
So, FOK, all of them, right now, IOC. Whatever you have, right now, AON, all of them. Take your time.
That is beautifully summarized. Now let's look at how the exam weaponizes these definitions.
Oh, let's do it. So think about this scenario, listener. You sit down at the testing center. Question 13 pops up. It says, a client enters an order to buy 500 contracts of corn. The order is allowed to sit on the exchange book for 2 hours, waiting until all 500 contracts can be matched at a specific price simultaneously. Which type of order is this?
And let's say the options are fill or kill, immediate or cancel, or all or none.
Right. So I'll pause. If your brain sees the phrase all 500 contracts matched simultaneously, does that mean it's fill or kill?
No, it absolutely does not. The trap here is that your brain reads all 500 and immediately associates it with the word entirety, which triggers your memory of fill or kill. But you miss the lethal detail. The order sat on the book for 2 hours.
Oh, resting period.
Yes. A true FOK can never, ever sit on the book and wait. Not for 2 hours, not for 2 seconds. If it can wait, it is an all or none order.
So the exam writers are basically playing word association games against you.
They really are. And it highlights how you must read these questions. You have to act like a detective looking for two very specific clues.
What's clue number one?
Clue number one. Does the scenario describe a partial fill? If it says fills 300 out of 500 and cancels the rest, FOK is dead immediately. The moment you see partial, it has to be IOC.
Okay, partial means IOC. What's clue number two?
Clue number two. Does the scenario describe the order waiting or resting? If yes, FOK is dead again. It has to be AON. You can only select fill or kill if the scenario explicitly demands both completion and instantaneous action.
That is such a good breakdown. Okay, I want to tie this back to the high-frequency trading thought you mentioned earlier with GTC orders.
Oh, the algorithms, yes.
Yeah, how does this AON order, you know, Fiona standing in the lobby waiting for her 100 tickets, how does that actually work inside a modern electronic matching engine?
This is where market microstructure gets fascinating. And honestly, understanding this makes the concept unforgettable. Think about an AON order for 500 contracts resting on an electronic exchange. The matching engine has to literally bypass available liquidity to honor that order.
Wait, bypass? What do you mean?
Let's say the order book has sell orders of 100, then another 100, then 50, then 200. There are sellers out there. But because Fiona's order says all or none, the matching engine looks at those smaller orders, says, nope, not 500, and just skips them.
It just ignores them.
It ignores them. It leaves Fiona's massive order sitting there, visible to the market, waiting for a single 500-lot seller to show up.
Wait, so I could just sit there all day while millions of contracts trade in smaller chunks right in front of my face and my order never fills?
Yes, that is the fundamental risk of AON. But it gets worse. Remember the algorithms. HFT firms are constantly scanning the order book. They see Fiona's massive AON order resting there. Because she's telegraphing that she desperately wants 500 contracts at a specific price, the algorithms know there's massive buying pressure sitting right underneath the market.
It's like a giant flashing beacon that says whale spotted.
Exactly. Predatory algorithms can use a tactic called pennying or front running in dark pools. They know Fiona is a guaranteed buyer at, say, $50, so they step in front of her, buy up all the smaller chunks of liquidity at $50.01 and drive the price up.
Oh, that's brutal.
Fiona never gets her fill because her AON restriction made her too rigid and too visible. A rule that made perfect sense when a floor broker was secretly holding a ticket in his pocket in 1985 is suddenly a massive vulnerability on a fiber optic network in 2026.
That completely flips how I view these orders. The rigidity of AON actually makes it fragile.
It really does.
Okay, let's take a breath. We've survived the marathon runner, Deliberate Dave, and we've survived the bridezilla, Frantic Fiona. Now, what if a trader doesn't care about a specific limit price? What if they don't care about getting filled in the middle of the day at all? What if their entire strategy relies on executing at the exact moment the market closes?
Now we are moving to settlement, Sam, and the market on close order, the MOC.
A market on close order is structurally simple, right? It is just a standard market order, but it has a highly specific timer attached to it. It is an instruction to delay execution until the very end of the trading session, executing within what is called the closing range.
Right. And to understand why Sam would use this, we have to reiterate what a market order actually is. A market order is a price taker. You are submitting to the market and saying, I surrender control over the price. I will accept whatever the prevailing market price happens to be when my order arrives.
Which is always a little scary.
It is. But by attaching the on-close instruction, you are taking that surrender of price control and delaying it until the most volatile, chaotic final minutes of the day. An MOC order guarantees participation in the close. It absolutely does not guarantee a specific price.
So why would a professional trader ever hand over a blank check to the market at the most chaotic time of day? Isn't that incredibly reckless?
Yeah.
Like, why not just use a limit order to protect yourself?
It sounds reckless until you understand the institutional realities of tracking error. Let's look at Settlement Sam. Sam manages a multi-billion dollar mutual fund that promises its investors it will perfectly track the S&P 500 index.
Okay, no pressure.
Right. Every single evening, mutual funds report their net asset value, their NAV. That NAV is calculated based on the official closing prices of the market. If Sam gets a massive influx of cash from investors on a Tuesday morning, he has to deploy that cash into the market. But if he buys at noon and the market crashes at 3:50 p.m., his fund is going to severely underperform the official closing index value. His investors will be furious.
Ah, because he bought high at noon, but the scorecard is graded based on the 4:00 p.m. close.
Exactly. Sam's professional survival depends on matching the 4:00 p.m. closing price as closely as humanly possible. If he uses a limit order to try and get a good price and the market runs away from him, his limit order never fills. He goes home holding cash instead of stocks, and he completely fails to track the index.
He misses the boat entirely.
Yes. The MOC order sacrifices price certainty in order to completely eliminate execution uncertainty. Sam is guaranteed to be fully invested by the bell.
Okay, let's bring in an analogy to really cement the risk profile of this order. Settlement Sam is downtown, and he desperately needs to get to the Stock Exchange building before the doors lock at 4:00 p.m.
Okay.
He jumps into a taxi at 3:45 p.m., and he says to the driver, "Listen, I don't care what route you take. I don't care how bad the traffic is. Just get me to the exchange before they lock the doors. I will pay whatever the meter says when we arrive."
That perfectly encapsulates the MOC. Sam is guaranteed to arrive before the doors shut. That is his guaranteed participation in the close. But the taxi driver, the traffic, the route, which represent the market liquidity, they completely control the meter. The final price is entirely unknown until the exact moment of arrival.
Sam might expect the ride to cost $20, but if there's a massive accident on the bridge and the meter runs up to $50, he still has to pay it. He guaranteed his arrival, not his fare.
And this brings us to the biggest, most heavily tested exam trap regarding the MOC order.
Ooh, all right, what is it?
The exam loves to prey on the assumption that the close and the settlement price are the exact same thing. They are not synonyms.
Okay, think about this, listener. Sam submits his market on close order. He gets in his taxi. At 4:00 p.m., the closing bell rings, and his order is filled. 30 minutes later, the exchange publishes the official daily settlement price in the newspaper or on Bloomberg. So I'll pause. Is Sam's filled price guaranteed to be exactly the identical penny as that official published settlement price?
The answer is no, absolutely not. And to understand why, you have to understand the mathematical reality of how an exchange actually calculates a settlement price.
It's not just a single snapshot.
No, the close is not a single magical microsecond. It is a window of time. It is a period of trading, usually the last 30 to 60 seconds before the bell rings. This window is called the closing range. During this window, absolute chaos ensues. Thousands of institutional MOC orders are flooding the matching engine. Trades are firing off rapidly at slightly different prices, $100.01, $100.05, $99.98.
Just a blur of numbers.
Yes. Sam's MOC order lands somewhere inside that chaotic window. It gets matched at whatever random price ticked at the exact millisecond his order was processed.
Okay, so the closing range is a flurry of raw data.
Yes. Now contrast that with the official settlement price. The settlement price is a single polished statistic. After the bell rings, the exchange's computers take a breath. They look back at all the thousands of trades that happened during that closing range, and they calculate a volume-weighted average price.
So they mathematically smooth out the chaos to find the true center of gravity.
Exactly. Because the settlement price is a calculated average derived after the fact, Sam's specific MOC fill, which was just one single raw data point in that flurry, may or may not exactly equal the final calculated average.
Going back to the taxi analogy, the official settlement price is like the city publishing a statistical report the next morning that says the average taxi fare to the exchange at 4 p.m. yesterday was exactly $25.50.
Right.
But Sam's specific taxi ride might have hit three red lights and cost him $26. Or he might have caught a green wave and only paid 24. He got there at the close. His price was near the average, but it was absolutely not locked into being exactly $25.50.
That is the crucial distinction. On the exam, they will give you a statement like, "A market on close order guarantees the trader will receive the official daily settlement price. You must recognize that as a false statement. MOC guarantees participation in the closing range. It does not guarantee the calculated settlement price."
Got it. MOC equals participation, not price. Closing range equals a window of time. Settlement equals a calculated mathematical average. That is a great distinction.
It's vital for the exam.
And just to tie a bow on the HFT aspect here, because we know MOC orders flood the market at the end of the day, do exchanges just let this happen blindly? Like, do they just hope there's enough liquidity?
No, because it would cause massive flash crashes every day. To handle this, exchanges publish MOC imbalance data at around 3.45 p.m. They essentially announce to the market, hey, we have way more sell MOC orders than buy MOC orders coming in.
Oh, they broadcast the imbalance.
They do. This allows HFTs and market makers to step in and provide liquidity to absorb Sam's taxi ride. But it also means they know Sam is coming, and they price their liquidity accordingly.
Fascinating. So even at the close, you are showing your hand.
Always.
Okay, let's reset for a second. We have covered the marathon runners that wait forever, the GTCs. We've covered the bridezillas that refuse to wait, the FOKs. And we've covered the taxi riders who only care about the final bell, the MOCs.
We've covered a lot of ground.
We have. But up to this point, we have been looking at single isolated orders that have special instructions attached to them. But what happens when Deliberate Dave wants to set up a sophisticated trap? What if he wants to enter two separate orders at the same time and have them mathematically interact with each other based on market conditions?
Now we are stepping into conditional logic. We are talking about the one cancels the other order, or the OCO.
The OCO. I like to call these the wired alarms. But before we break down mechanics, we have to talk about the pit trading disaster that forced this order into existence, because this is crazy.
Oh, the manual era of this was wild.
I was reading up on the history of this, and it is hilarious and terrifying how traders used to implement this strategy manually. In the physical pit, if a trader wanted two conditional orders, they literally had to give two separate paper tickets to two different guys in the pit.
A literal recipe for disaster.
Complete disaster. The strategy requires that if one ticket gets executed, the other one must be immediately destroyed. So the first guy is standing there screaming his order. The market hits his price. He gets filled. He then has to physically turn around, spot the second guy across a sea of screaming bodies, and frantically wave his hands or yell, cancel the other ticket.
And in 1985, in a pit with 300 people.
Right. If the second guy's looking away or the noise is too loud, the market might hit the second price too. The second guy executes his ticket. Suddenly, the trader who just wanted to safely exit his position is now holding double the exposure, totally by accident, all because of human error.
And that massive operational risk is exactly why modern electronic exchanges created the OCO.
The wired alarms.
Yes, the wired alarms. An OCO instruction consists of two distinct independent orders that are entered into the trading platform at the exact same time. The exchange's computer mathematically links them together. The rule is absolute. The microsecond one of those orders is executed and filled by the matching engine, the system instantly, automatically routes a cancellation message to the other order and pulls it from the book.
The computer acts as the guy yelling across the pit, but it does it at the speed of light and it never gets distracted.
Exactly. The two legs of the order are mutually exclusive. Only one of them can ever actually result in a trade.
So why would you link two orders together in a suicide pact where one surviving kills the other? What is the actual trading utility here?
The primary, almost exclusive use case that the Series 3 exam tests for an OCO is a strategy called bracketing.
Bracketing, like putting parentheses around a math equation.
Yes. Traders use an OCO pair to surround or bracket an existing open position with two opposite exit doors. They want to place a profit-taking target on one side of the current price and a protective loss-capping safety net on the other side.
Let's bring back Deliberate Dave to demonstrate this, because this is his favorite order. It aligns perfectly with his desire to set a system up once and never look at his screen again.
He loves an OCO.
He does. Mm. Let's say Dave bought a crude oil futures contract at $80. He is long. Yeah. He wants the price to go up. Dave decides his entire strategy in advance. If the price goes up to $90, he wants to take his $10 profit and go home happy. But if his thesis is wrong and the price crashes down to $75, he wants to cut his losses and get out before he loses his shirt.
Makes sense.
He wants both of these exit plans active in the market at the exact same time.
Because Dave is long, his exits require him to sell. Mm-hmm. So Dave uses an OCO instruction to set his bracket. First, he enters a sell limit order above the current market at $90. This is his profit target. Simultaneously, link as an OCO, he enters a sell stop order below the current market at $75. This is his protective safety net.
He has beautifully bracketed his $80 entry price. Limit at 90, stop at 75.
Now, let's watch the computer work. Let's say a positive inventory report comes out and crude oil shoots up to $90. Dave's sell limit order is triggered. The exchange matches him with a buyer, and he captures his $10 profit.
Nice job, Dave.
Yeah, but here is the magic. The very millisecond that limit order fills, the exchange's matching engine recognizes the OCO link. It immediately reaches down to the $75 sell stop order resting on the book and automatically deletes it.
And this is where the wired alarms analogy clicks. Dave essentially wired two alarms to his position. One alarm goes off if the pizza arrives. That's the $90 profit limit.
Pizza alarm. I like that.
Yeah. And the other alarm goes off if the house catches on fire. That's the $75 stop loss. The OCO instruction wires them together so that if the pizza alarm goes off, the fire alarm is automatically disabled. Dave doesn't have to run over and manually turn off the fire alarm while he's trying to eat his pizza.
That is exactly right. And that lack of manual intervention is the first major exam trap for the OCO.
Okay, think about this scenario for the exam, guys. Dave's OCO profit limit just hit. He got his $90. His position is closed. I'm asking you directly. Does Dave need to immediately log into his brokerage app and manually cancel his $75 stop loss to avoid accidentally entering a brand new short position if the market suddenly reverses and crashes?
I guarantee you, the trader must manually cancel the remaining open order will be option A or option B on the multiple choice question. Do not click it.
It's a huge trap.
It is. The platform handles it entirely. The cancellation is automatic. That is the fundamental definition of one cancels the other. The C in OCO stands for cancels, not customer must cancel.
Okay, that makes sense. But I know there is a second, even more devious trap with the OCO bracket. And it has to do with the actual placement of the orders.
Yes. The exam will test your fundamental understanding of order mechanics by asking you to construct the bracket correctly from scratch. You must never flip the placement of the limit and the stop.
Let's re-examine Dave's setup. He was long at 80. He placed a sell limit above at 90 and a sell stop below at 75. Let me challenge this. They're both just sell orders, right? Why can't you just put a sell stop at 90 and a sell limit at 75? Wouldn't that accomplish the exact same thing?
This goes back to the very definition of basic orders from the previous unit, but it is the number one reason candidates fail OCO questions. You have to remember what the words mean to the matching engine.
Okay, remind us.
A limit order says, fill me at this price or better. A stop order says, don't do anything until the price gets this bad, then trigger into a market order and get me out.
Okay, so follow the logic if Dave flips them. Dave is long at 80. He places a sell limit at 75, which is below the current market price.
He is explicitly telling the exchange, I want to sell my crude oil at 75 or better. Well, current market price of 80 is technically better than 75. As a seller, you'd rather get 80 than 75. Mm. So the exchange's computer looks at that order, says, wow, Dave is offering to sell at 75 when buyers are willing to pay 80. This is a great deal. And it instantly fills his order right now at 80.
Oh, my God. His protective safety net just triggered immediately and closed his position for zero profit.
It's an instant misfire.
That's terrible.
It is. And conversely, if he places a sell stop above the market at 90, he is saying, wait until the price rises to an awesome level of 90 and then turn into a market order and sell to whoever is there.
Wait, but why would you ever want to trigger a chaotic, unpredictable market order when the price is moving in your favor?
You wouldn't. You use a limit order to cleanly capture good prices. Stops are strictly for stopping pain.
Okay, that completely clarifies it. A limit order looks for better prices. A stop order reacts to worse prices.
Yeah.
So the absolute golden rule for bracketing a long position. The limit order is for taking profit, so it always goes above the market. The stop order is for stopping loss, so it always goes below the market. Limits above, stops below. If you flip the bracket, your wired alarms will instantly blow up in your face the second you turn them on.
Exactly. An incorrectly placed bracket often executes immediately, defeating the entire purpose of the strategy and costing you unnecessary commission fees.
All right. We have traversed the landscape. We've seen the mechanics of the marathon runners, the bridezillas, the taxi riders, and the wired alarms. This brings us to the final critical step. We've explained the why and the how, but the exam is a timed pressure cooker. You need instant recall.
You have to be fast.
Yeah, so we're going to do a rapid fire side-by-side comparison to guarantee you can spot these specific traps under the clock.
Let's lock it in.
We are going to trade off. I will name the order and give its core definition, and you're going to hit us with the exact trap the exam is going to use against us. Ready?
We're ready. Let's run it.
First up, good till canceled, the GTC, also known as an open order. This order persists across trading sessions day after day, surviving the daily close until it is either filled or manually canceled. It is delivered day of on vacation.
The trap. Unmarked electronic orders. On modern platforms, an order without a specific time and force is assumed to be a day order. It will die at the close. GTC is an opt-in feature. Do not assume a resting order carries over automatically just because it's on a computer.
Boom. Next. Fill or kill, FOK. The bridezilla. Frantic Fiona. This order must be filled immediately, right this microsecond, AND in its entirety, the complete quantity. No partials, no resting. All or nothing, right now.
The trap. The cousins. Do not confuse FOK with immediate or cancel, IOC. The single word difference to look for is partial. IOC allows partial fills. FOK does not. Also, do not confuse FOK with all or none, AON. AON requires the entire quantity, but it is allowed to rest and wait on the book. If an order can wait, even for a second, it is AON, not FOK.
Excellent. Third, market on close, MOC. Settlement Sam in the taxi. A market order that is delayed and executed at or near the closing bell, participating in the final chaotic closing range of the trading session.
The trap. Confusing the close with the settlement. MOC guarantees participation in the closing window. It absolutely does not guarantee you will receive the official published daily settlement price. The settlement price is a mathematically calculated average. The MOC fill is just a raw trade from the final flurry of activity.
Last one. One cancels the other. OCO, the wired alarms. Two distinct orders entered together and mathematically linked, typically to bracket an existing position with a profit target and a stop loss.
The trap, the manual cancellation myth. A fill on either leg automatically cancels the other leg. The system does it. If a multiple choice option says the trader must manually cancel the surviving order, it's a trap.
And remember bracket placement. Limit above for profit. Stop below for protection. Never flip them.
That is the perfect summary. To everyone listening, if you can hold Dave, Fiona, and Sam in your mind and understand why they use those specific orders to manage their risk or their timing, you are not going to fall for the rote memorization traps.
You'll see right through them. Yeah, when you see a question about an order sitting on the book for 2 hours, you won't just see the words entire quantity and guess fill or kill. You'll think of Fiona standing in the lobby waiting, and you'll know it's all or none. You'll be reasoning your way through the exam.
The mechanics dictate the strategy. If you know the mechanics, the test becomes transparent.
Absolutely. Well, I want to congratulate you on surviving the deepest dive into additional orders. This is structurally dense material, but you've got the narrative tools now to tear it apart on test day.
Before we sign off, I want to leave you with one final thought. We've talked extensively today about how these rigid rules function in theory and how they evolve from the physical trading pits to the electronic order book.
Right.
But consider how the endless march of technology continues to warp these tools. We touched on how an all-or-none order acts as a flashing beacon for high-frequency trading algorithms. Think about the arms race happening right now. HFT firms spend billions of dollars to lay fiber optic cables through mountains just to shave 3 milliseconds off their connection time to the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
Just milliseconds. It's insane.
It is. If you are using a strictly conditional order like an IOC or an AON, you are effectively showing your hand to an ecosystem of predatory machines that can process information, detect your hidden intentions, and front-run your order before your blink reflex even finishes.
It's wild. You think you're protecting yourself with a strict condition, but you're actually painting a target on your back.
Exactly. The rules of the Series 3 remain the same, but the reality of the market microstructure is a constantly shifting battlefield. Understanding why an order exists gives you the foundation to understand how it can be exploited tomorrow.
That is definitely something to chew on as you continue your prep. The rules stay the same, but the ecosystem evolves. Well, that is all the time we have for this deep dive. Remember, understanding the mechanics, the why behind the textbook, is your ultimate shortcut. Don't just memorize. Understand the characters, understand the history, and understand the logic. Keep studying, keep challenging the material, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.